It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 75 years ago, a mayor from Minneapolis challenged the Democratic Party to take action on civil rights and fight racism and anti-Semitism. We explore the rise of Hubert Humphrey's political career and how to view his fight for equality and justice in respect to politics now. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Samuel Friedman is a journalism professor at Columbia University, has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, a graduate of UW-Madison. New book is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey in the Fight for Civil Rights. Sam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's so great to be here with you. A real honor.
Your book, focusing on the struggle for racial and democratic equality in the 40s, why is it important to explore this era, this period now?
That's a great question. One of the main reasons is that when people think about the civil rights movement and often write about it, there's this assumption that it starts in the middle of the 1950s with the Brown versus Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court that outlaws school segregation, with Rosa Parks and Dr. King and the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. But you really couldn't have the civil rights landmarks of the 1950s and all the subsequent struggle and achievement if you hadn't had this fervent decade of activism in the 1940s, a lot of which is really inextricably bound up with World War II and with the concept of defeating fascism abroad and then dealing with the unfinished agenda of inequality in America itself.
Hubert Humphrey, elected mayor of Minneapolis in 1945. Can you set the scene for us? What was the racial climate like in the Midwest at that time?
Minneapolis itself, people should disabuse themselves of the idea of Minneapolis as a blue city then, and in some ways even now, but certainly then. Minneapolis was notorious nationally as a hotbed of anti-Semitism and racism. It was a city that had been very welcoming to pro-Nazi sentiments in the forms of groups like the Silver Shirts and individuals like Gerald L.K. Smith, founder of the America First Party. It was a place in which Blacks, yes, were able to work, but only in fairly servile occupations, where if they tried to move out of their ghetto on the north side of Minneapolis, there are numerous instances of their homes being besieged and really terrorist mobs
like
trying to
what
drive
happened
them
to
out.
Arthur Lee. I mean, you describe in such detail about what Arthur Lee's family went through in Minneapolis.
Right. Arthur Lee is a World War I veteran, works at the post office, buys a home in an otherwise white sort of middle-class, lower-middle-class neighborhood in South Minneapolis in the summer of 1931. And night after night through that summer, thousands of people besiege his house. They poison the family dog. They vandalize the house. They throw such a fear into the family that the Lee's daughter needs a police escort, even a couple months later when the school year starts, to go to kindergarten. So, you know, these were not anomalies in Minneapolis. These were very normative and very accepted by the mainstream of Minneapolis society. And that's the world that Humphrey takes on. Now, he's not the first person, of course, to fight these battles. And in fact, he learns important lessons from Jews and Blacks and Catholics in Minneapolis who've been trying to take on bigotry in the previous decades. But those people have been fundamentally powerless. They're outnumbered in a city that's overwhelmingly Protestant, Northern European, Scandinavian, British Isles. Humphrey is the first person to really come into the city and provide both political ambition and political skills to the cause of fighting for equality.
Sam Friedman is the author of the new book, Into the Bright Sunshine, as we talk about the push for civil rights after World War II. And get your questions and insights along the way. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sam, another person central in your book is Cecil Newman, the founder and publisher of the Minneapolis Spokesman and the St. Paul Recorder. What is important about Newman?
Cecil Newman is Hubert Humphrey's conscience on matters of race. Humphrey would not have done what he did on civil rights, I think, without the influence of Cecil Newman. Cecil Newman was a former Pullman Railroad porter, which was sort of a black middle class occupation at that time. And he took the money he saved being a porter to found a couple of newspapers, most importantly, as you said, the Minneapolis Spokesman and St. Paul Recorder. He's founded them in the mid-1930s. And Cecil Newman is absolutely tireless in using the pages of his newspapers to call out all the different versions of racism that pervaded Minneapolis, everything from labor unions that wouldn't have black members, breweries that wouldn't hire black workers, the mainstream newspapers using coded language and writing about black life, so that invariably the coverage was only about crime when it dealt with black people. And Newman was just all over this. He also addressed national politics as well. And he was very unimpressed by Franklin Roosevelt on matters of race. So Cecil Newman was not the only activist in Minneapolis. There were others, including a really exceptional civil rights lawyer named Lena Olive Smith. But Cecil Newman, in some way, was the most prominent figure trying to fight this battle and trying to call attention to it. And in some ways, waiting and waiting and waiting for someone like Hubert Humphrey to finally show up on the scene, someone who was not only possessed of a conscience, because there are white people of conscience who Newman interacted with, but someone who had a conscience and had political power.
I was wondering, you know, what did Newman see in Humphrey, and how did Newman know that Humphrey was authentic about his, you know, about his platform to really change the course for human rights and civil rights?
A great question. One thing that's important to know, and we can talk more at length about this later, is that when Humphrey really starts his career in public life in Minneapolis in late 1940, he's come straight from a year of graduate school at Louisiana State. Mm-hmm. And during that year in Baton Rouge, he'd been immersed in a Jim Crow society for the first time. And it just offended his moral sensibilities. And a lot of people would come north and say, well, I'm really glad I'm out of the benighted South now. And that was sort of Minneapolis's complacent sense of itself. But Humphrey is different. He takes what he saw in Baton Rouge, and it gives him clear eyes for the first time to see the racial inequalities and the bigotry in Minneapolis. And one of his first jobs in Minneapolis is working with the WPA, the New Deal Agency, the Work Progress Administration, initially doing worker education and then war mobilization, basically morale building. And Cecil Newman begins to hear, you know, over the transom that Hubert Humphrey is giving blacks equal opportunities to get jobs in the WPA, which had not been the case prior to that. Even though there was officially not segregation in Minnesota, the fact was that New Deal programs were administered in a racially unequal way. And Humphrey is defying that. And Newman begins to hear about that. And Humphrey does things like give speeches at black churches and at the main settlement house in the black neighborhood on the north side, and just shows a willingness to engage that was so utterly rare. And at some point, and I don't know exactly when, but at some point, probably in 1941, 42, 43, Newman and Humphrey begin to meet each other face to face. And Humphrey becomes kind of a regular visitor to Newman's newspaper office, and again, is really learning from him along the way. And that just lays down the foundation. And when Newman starts to write about Humphrey in the pages of the Spokesman, or to have his staff reporters write about him, what he's conveying is that this is someone who has treated us fairly. Hmm. And that in and of itself makes Hubert Humphrey stick out.
Columbia University journalism professor and UW alum Sam Friedman's new book, it's called Into the Bright Sunshine, as we explore the rise of Hubert Humphrey's strong civil rights plank for the Democratic Party 75 years ago. Thoughts on this legacy today. Be part of the conversation at any point. Call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new biography called Into the Bright Sunshine. It examines how Hubert Humphrey was a trailblazer for human rights and dismantling racism. 75 years ago, the Minneapolis mayor and the future presidential candidate for the Democratic Party made the case for a strong civil rights plank. And as we explore how this history connects to politics today, you can call in with a question or a comment along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Columbia University journalism professor and author Sam Friedman is here, also a UW-Madison alumnus. Sam, backing up to World War II, many African Americans fighting for the United States. How were these Black veterans received when they returned home from the war?
Kate, it's a great question. And I want to work to the answer by first talking about what the ideology was and the hopes of the Black GIs who went into the war. There was a slogan called Double V that was put together by the great Black newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and it stood for double victory. And the idea was, we're going to fight on behalf of this country that at best treats us as second-class citizens, sometimes barely treats us as human at all. And we're going to make our sacrifices in the war against fascism, which included, of course, concepts of racial superiority, Aryan superiority. And then we're going to come back on the home front and leverage what we did on behalf of this country to ask this country to finally make good on its promise of equality to us. That was the concept of double victory. And it was incredibly influential. And by the way, Jewish GIs didn't have a term like double V, but they'd exactly the same concept. But these Black veterans come back, and the spectacle of a Black man in the uniform of the United States military coming back to a Southern town and making a point of registering to vote, or coming in the front door of the restaurant, or sitting in the front rows of a bus, is absolutely intolerable to the white supremacists of the South. And so what you have are a wave of attacks, some of them fatal, against Black veterans in the South. And the one that probably becomes most known and really ends up affecting Harry Truman himself is an attack on a returning Army sergeant named Isaac Woodard, who's pulled off a bus in a South Carolina town, and the town sheriff gouges his eyes out. Mm. And Woodard, to his credit, then goes around the country speaking about the need to desegregate the military and about the broader civil rights agenda. He becomes this national symbol of race hate in America. And the idea that this would happen to a war veteran is an attempt to sort of shame the country into doing better. And as I said, this is an episode that comes to Harry Truman's attention. And Truman, up to this point, has had no particular interest in civil rights. But there's something about him, I think a little similar to Lyndon Johnson later, that he is a conscience that can be affected by individual incidents like this, and it gets him to start to move forward on civil rights.
Southern Democrats opposed civil rights legislation, opposed anti-lynching laws. Can you explain the Democratic Party's dynamic on civil rights issues in the 1940s?
I'm really glad you asked, because it'll be such a shock and revelation to a lot of listeners today. But the New Deal coalition assembled by Franklin Roosevelt had some of the expected components. It had college-educated intellectuals. It had Jews and Catholics from big cities who were from immigrant families. It had organized labor. But then it had this one wing that seems completely contradictory, which was the segregationist Democratic Party in the South. But because the Civil War was associated with the Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln, and so was emancipation and Reconstruction, the white supremacists of the South all flocked into the Democratic Party. And FDR made this calculation, which I would say is almost literally a devil's bargain, that he would appease and placate the segregationist wing of the party because he felt like he needed the votes from those Southern states to win in the Electoral College to be elected to the White House. And he needed the support of these very senior, high-ranking Southern senators and representatives in Congress to move New Deal legislation through Congress. And what FDR offered in return was some New Deal programs like Social Security were written to exclude agricultural and domestic workers, which was to say 90% of working Blacks in the South. All New Deal programs were administered locally, which meant that if you had a Jim Crow state, you would administer the Civilian Conservation Corps or the WPA or the PWA or rural electrification in a racially unequal way. And when it came to the party's platform, FDR made sure that there was no language explicitly endorsing civil rights. He did this, by the way, in spite of the fact that the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, was a fervent advocate for civil rights. And even with her advocacy, FDR wouldn't move on it. And so the language about civil rights in the platform was always fuzzy and vague and equivocal. And the idea was that it would allow the segregationists to interpret it as allowing them what they called states' rights. States' rights was a euphemism that basically meant if the Constitution itself doesn't say that the Southern states and the whole country must be racially equal, then every state gets to make up its own mind. And we've made up our mind that we're going to have a Jim Crow system. And FDR was willing to tolerate that in order to be elected. And actually, heading into the 1948 convention, Harry Truman, who of course became president after FDR's death in 1945, Harry Truman is willing to operate on the same playbook, even though it goes against what had been some of his own recommendations on civil rights.
Sam Friedman, author of the new book, Into the Bright Sunshine, as we discuss the push for civil rights after World War II. And you can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Bringing in a bit of Wisconsin here, you write about Andrew B. Miller, who represented Wisconsin in the House of Representatives. What role did B. Miller have in the civil rights movement of the 1940s? And what influence did B. Miller have on Humphrey?
Great question, Kate, because he's really one of the unsung heroes. If Humphrey hasn't gotten nearly enough credit for what he did on civil rights in the 1940s, then Andrew B. Miller is even more obscure to almost everybody. And as you said, he was a member of Congress from Milwaukee. He'd also been a labor activist. He, early in his career, had been part of the progressive movement, the La Follette movement in Wisconsin, and served in the state legislature. The really important thing that B. Miller does is that the 1948 Democratic Convention, the big issue is going to be civil rights. And the insurgent liberals within the party, including Humphrey, have to figure out how they're going to be able to get this issue before the whole convention. And one of the ways that Southerners has held great power in Congress and in the Democratic Party is that a lot of them became very expert in these abstruse rules of parliamentary procedure that the party used. It wasn't Robert's Rules of Order. It was a variation on it that was even less common. And Andy B. Miller, when he was in Congress, decided to learn these rules inside and out. He learned them from Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House. And so when the insurgents are trying to pass their civil rights plank in 1948 against Truman's opposition, with the Southerners threatening to walk out, and they lose at the committee level, they lose at the platform committee, in order to take it before the whole convention delegates, Andy B. Miller knows exactly how to play the rules in order to give Hubert Humphrey the opportunity to speak. And when B. Miller goes and presents, you know, all the backup number of sponsors and so forth to Sam Rayburn that allow Humphrey to speak, Rayburn is just flummoxed. He says the fat's in the fire now, which is a cliche that means there's going to be a big blaze. But that's what B. Miller was able to do, is to give Humphrey the opportunity to give the speech which would become so famous and so influential. Without what B. Miller was doing deep in the weeds of parliamentary procedure, there is no Humphrey speech.
We're going to get into that speech, but you also said B. Miller operated in a precarious middle ground, simultaneously attacked as being too radical, not radical enough, very much what like Humphrey experienced.
Absolutely. At this time, you're getting the emergence of what's going to ultimately be called anti-communist liberalism. And what it means is that there are people like Humphrey B. Miller, a group called the Americans for Democratic Action, which Humphrey was very involved with, individual senators like Paul Douglas from Illinois, for instance, who are absolutely liberal in terms of the social safety net, who are absolutely liberal in favor of civil rights, but because they've broken with not only members of the Communist Party, who are small in number, but people who are part of what was called the Popular Front, people who were sympathetic to the U.S.-Soviet alliance in World War II.
That puts them in a difficult position. Pausing there with Sam Friedman, author of Into the Bright Sunshine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine Hubert Humphrey's early efforts to advance a civil rights platform in the Democratic Party and how Humphrey's work 75 years ago connects with struggles against racism and inequality today. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Columbia University journalism professor and UW-Madison alum Sam Friedman's new biography is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights. Sam, take us to the 1948 Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Why was Humphrey invited to speak?
Well, the 1948 convention in Philadelphia is going to nominate Harry Truman for president for a full term, which is to the great chagrin of almost everyone in the party. Everyone assumes Truman is going to be defeated. He's very unpopular at this point. So the big drama and the big looming battle of the convention is whether the Democratic Party is finally going to endorse civil rights. And you have kind of four, four factions, bringing their political might into the convention. You have liberal insurgents, including Hubert Humphrey, who want the civil rights plank. You have Southern segregationists led by Strom Thurmond and the governor of Mississippi, Fielding Wright, who have vowed if there's a word of civil rights language in this platform, we're leaving, we're going to run our own candidate for president, and we're going to try to cost Harry Truman the presidency as a result. You have Truman and his people who are saying, we don't want civil rights language. We want to keep the Southerners inside the tent. Let's just do the same vague, equivocal, fuzzy civil rights language that FDR always did. And then literally outside the convention hall, you have the great Black labor and civil rights leader, A. Philip Randolph, leading protest marches as part of a campaign asking young Black men not to register for the draft and not to serve if called up until Harry Truman desegregates the military. Because the fact that after defeating fascism, America's own army is still racially segregated has become maybe the top line civil rights issue in the entire country at this point. Hmm. So all these factions, all these constituencies are coming into battle during this week in mid-July 1948 in Philadelphia. And the plan for the insurgents is to try to introduce a plank that, as it ultimately does, will explicitly say the Democratic Party supports desegregating the military. We want anti-lynching legislation passed. We want an end to the poll tax. And importantly, Kate, the language of that plank ultimately also says that the protection from discrimination, the guarantee of equality, should be along the lines of not only race, but also religion and national origin. So this plank is also tremendously important to American Jews, to American Catholics, to Japanese Americans who are just coming out of having been incarcerated by their own country during the war, by the growing Mexican American population, indigenous Americans. So this is a broadly important part of the Democratic platform if the insurgents can get it through. And that's the big question of this week in Philadelphia.
And your book takes its name from a line of Humphrey's speech at that 1948 convention, and we're going to listen to some of it.
To those who say that we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say to them, we are 172 years late. To those who say, that this civil rights program is an infringement on states' rights, I say this: the time has arrived in America for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights.
You hear a mixture in that speech of boos in the background. What was your immediate reaction to the speech?
Well, exactly right. You can't help, at least if you're constructed politically the way I am, to be stirred and moved by Humphrey's passion and eloquence. But you're also taken aback right away by the fact that the boos kind of outshout the cheers. And that is really important for people to listen to, because we shouldn't think that Hubert Humphrey was taking on some safe, pallid, middle-of-the-road issue. He was out there walking the plank, and the Southern reaction to it was a sign that the party was going to split over this issue, which indeed happened. And just to jump ahead, when Humphrey later made it into the Senate, the Southern senators there, who had far more seniority than he did, took it out of his hide every way they could, which is something Robert Caro writes about in his, you know, extraordinary multi-volume Lyndon Johnson biography. So Humphrey knew that he was taking great risk here, and the boos were in a way the most obvious part, but the other risk he was taking was defying Harry Truman. Truman's people weren't going to boo Humphrey, but privately, before Humphrey gave that speech, one of the senators who was a point person for Truman on the convention said to Humphrey in so many words, "If you give this speech, your political career is over." Humphrey, in a committee hearing, was called a pipsqueak. Harry Truman's writing in his diary of the civil rights forces within the Democratic Party that they're crackpots. He uses that term explicitly for Andrew B. Miller and extends it to everybody else on the civil rights side. And Humphrey's just a kid, really. He's 37 years old. He's only been in elected office for 3 years, and it's been as a mayor of a mid-sized city. Because he lost so much time during college to the Great Depression and having to drop out and help his family economically survive, this guy hadn't even gotten his bachelor's degree till he was 27 years old. And here he is, only 10 years later, daring to address the entire nation. I'm sorry, 60 million people listening on radio, 10 million watching on TV. It's like the Super Bowl.
What an orator. I was struck just by how his words and what he put together in his speeches. What was his way of writing a speech?
Humphrey, at least with this speech, he spoke it out. He had pulled an all-nighter in his hotel in Philadelphia with some of his closest allies and aides, and someone was jotting down notes as Humphrey was basically speaking out what would be the text. Then it was typed, and then Humphrey was self-editing it. And you can see the copy of the speech that's in the Minnesota Historical Society, his penciled in notes all along, what words to emphasize, what phrases to change. And so this is 95% Humphrey's work. And by the way, those wonderful passages you played, the lines about 172 years too late and walking into the bright sunshine, Humphrey had been trying out those phrases in previous speeches for almost a year. He'd been polishing them and burnishing them and slightly altering them, trying to get them exactly right, which he did in this speech. And the speech goes for just 10 minutes. And I think that's a big advantage to Humphrey, because he tended to talk too long, as many of us remember. And even his wife Muriel once said to him, "Hubert, a speech need not be eternal to be immortal." She really called him on his stuff, and she was right. But this speech, by convention rules, could only be 10 minutes, and that was a big advantage to Humphrey. And he has these great soaring flights of eloquence in it. He also talks about the fact that during the Cold War, the United States can't look like the country of racial inequality and let the Soviet Union look like the country of racial equality when there's this global battle for the political affiliation of these soon-to-be decolonized countries in Africa and Asia and Central and South America. And then the one line that Humphrey doesn't write himself, but that's really dispositive, is given to him by a woman named Eugenie Anderson, who is a Democrat Farmer Labor Party activist from southeastern Minnesota, from Red Wing, and will ultimately go on to actually be one of the first female ambassadors for the United States. And Eugenie Anderson comes up with the idea, we're only saying things in this plank that Harry Truman in the past has himself endorsed, even though he's trying to walk away from his own positions now. So let's just throw our arms around Harry Truman and congratulate him and salute him for what he's done. And it was a brilliant addition to the speech, because what it allowed the delegates to say to themselves is, I'm not contravening what Truman wants. I'm voting for what Truman himself has espoused just a year earlier. And all of that together works to win a majority of the delegates on the convention floor and to get this plank added to the party to the party platform.
Sam Friedman, author of the new book, Into the Bright Sunshine, as we look at the push for civil rights after World War II, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Pam is joining us in Verona. Pam, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I had a question about the 1964 Democratic convention. I saw something on, or I heard something on PBS the other evening about the Mississippi Freedom Party, how it was integrated, and that the regular Mississippi Democratic Party was totally white, and that there was real risk of the Mississippi Freedom Party becoming the Democratic Party at the convention, that LBJ was horrified that he prevailed or urged, insisted that LBJ have the Mississippi, or persuade the Mississippi Freedom Party to accept a compromise where they would get two of, I think, 50 or 60 delegate positions at the convention. Otherwise, LBJ would not select Humphrey as his vice president. I'm wondering if there is context or truth to that claim, that although Humphrey was a civil rights pioneer, that he was, you know, ground under LBJ's heel at this particular junction.
Pam, thank you.
Right. That's, you're broadly correct, and I'll address it in a second. But what's really amazing is that at the 1948 convention, there's something very similar. And hardly anyone knows about this. In 1948, there is a segregated, all-white, pro-Jim Crow delegation from Mississippi, just as there was also in 1964. And in 1948, a group of liberal and moderate, they're all white at this point, but liberal and moderate Mississippians come to the convention and say, this segregationist slate of Mississippi delegates should be thrown out of the convention. And the battle overseeing them, which is led by a liberal minister from Mississippi, but is taken to the convention floor by a Black civil rights lawyer from St. Louis, nearly wins. And one of the delegates who helps bring that to the floor is Hubert Humphrey's father, who's a delegate from South Dakota. And the fact that this segregationist slate of delegates almost got tossed out in 1948 is happening literally the day before Humphrey's civil rights plank goes through. So it's a sign that there's a lot more sympathy for civil rights in the 48 delegates than had been previously perceived. Jump ahead to 1964, and you're right, Mississippi is still sending a slate of Jim Crow delegates, and the Mississippi Freedom Party, which is mostly Black, but also integrated alternate party that's in favor of desegregation and civil rights laws, comes to the convention with its slate of delegates and demands that the Jim Crow slate get tossed out. And Johnson's fear is mostly that there'll be a big blow up at the convention and this will hurt his reelection chances that fall. You have to keep in mind, by this time, Johnson, with Humphrey's help in the Senate, has pushed through the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So it's not as if in any way he's trying to dodge civil rights, but he's worried about a big nationally televised row at the convention. And what he does is basically make Hubert Humphrey audition for the position of vice president by going to the Mississippi Freedom Party and saying, you're going to get two delegates out of, I don't know if it was as many as 50, I can't remember the exact number, but you're going to get two delegates. We're not going to put in your whole slate And that, of course, infuriates the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party at the time. But interestingly, what happens, the long tail of this, is most of the Mississippi Jim Crow delegates walk out anyway. And so most of the Mississippi Freedom delegates actually end up sitting in the convention. And as a result of their challenge to the Jim Crow delegation, the party changes its rules subsequently, and there will never be a segregated slate of delegates allowed in the Democratic National Convention again. So even though it looked like a sellout of the Mississippi Freedom Party at the time, it actually had incredibly positive effects down the road. So I would say that there's a defense that could be made of that compromise.
Columbia University journalism professor, graduate of UW-Madison, Sam Friedman, author of Into the Bright Sunshine, as we examine Hubert Humphrey's early years in politics, seeking to address racism and anti-Semitism. Call in with a question, share comments along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new biography on Hubert Humphrey. It focuses on his early political career, trying to unify the Democratic Party around a robust civil rights platform. And we examine this legacy and hold it in light of racism today. Call in with a question. Share what you think of this history. 800-642-1234. Columbia University journalism professor Sam Friedman's book is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights. Sam is an alum of UW-Madison. Fast forward to today, former President Donald Trump being the front runner for the Republican nomination next year, despite facing numerous criminal charges. Trump has been supported by neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups. What could the GOP learn from the Democratic Party of the 1940s in confronting extremist elements within its ranks?
Unfortunately, the GOP seems to be committed to refusing to learn the lesson of the Democrats in the 40s. The Democrats were willing, at their electoral peril, to oust a wing of the party that had an ideology that was toxic in light of movements for racial and religious equality in this country. They, you know, at the urging of people like Hubert Humphrey, pushed out a wing of the party. And even though Adlai Stevenson and John F. Kennedy try to bring the Southerners back in, when Lyndon Johnson becomes president, there's a permanent severing, and those people in the white supremacist South become part of the Republican Party of today. And today's Republican Party has obviously refused to reckon with that. It has refused to quarantine and to expel racists, anti-Semites, neo-Nazis, you name it. Everything's about the pragmatism of, can we pull together somehow enough electoral votes to win the White House, even with the minority of the popular vote, or can we just plain have a coup and take power that way? And if, you know, the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis and the Christian nationalists are our allies in that, then that's all we care about.
Humphrey goes on to serve in the Senate and as vice president. And in 68, the Democratic Party nominated him for president during this really contentious convention in Chicago. And let's listen to some of his speech from that 1968 convention.
Are we to be one nation, or are we to be a nation divided? Divided between black and white, between rich and poor, between north and south, between young and old. I take my stand. We are and we must be one nation.
So, Sam, today Humphrey may be best known as an establishment candidate who supported the Vietnam War. What do you see as Humphrey's legacy?
He has to have a two-part legacy, just as we can now see the totality of LBJ. Hubert Humphrey doesn't deserve a free pass for Vietnam. He ultimately acknowledged it was the gravest mistake of his political career, and he should take criticism in the eyes of history for the support of the war. It cost millions of lives here and in Vietnam. But we can't let that crowd out everything else he did. And unfortunately, in the popular memory, it has crowded that out. And here's someone who was probably, with the possible exception of Eleanor Roosevelt, the white person most committed to civil rights through the 1940s and early 1950s. We salute what Lyndon Johnson did as president on civil rights, and it deserves to be saluted. But Hubert Humphrey was on the civil rights issue 10, 12, 15 years before LBJ was, and he did it at a great cost. When he was mayor of Minneapolis, he was almost assassinated by a neo-Nazi who was opposed to Humphrey's, you know, activism against racism and anti-Semitism. What more could you ask than someone almost pay with their life and not be deterred, continue to fight even harder on behalf of an equal America? So we have to remember that when we take stock of Humphrey's entire public life.
When he challenged Lyndon Johnson on an exit strategy on Vietnam, did that compromise his ability to advance his civil rights in the administration, his role in the in administration?
I think, like Johnson himself, Humphrey was of two minds about Vietnam. We know from tapes of Johnson that as early as like 1964 and 65, he's confessing his doubts about the whole venture. And similarly, Humphrey, early in his vice presidency, expressed some doubts. Johnson was infuriated about it. But Hubert Humphrey was also a cold warrior. Hubert Humphrey was formed by the battles in Minnesota between the anti-communist left and the communist sympathizing left. And he later told George McGovern, a one-time protege who became his adversary in 1972, when they finally did reconcile as friends, he tells McGovern, "Everyone thought I supported Vietnam just to be loyal to Lyndon, but that's not true. I believed in it. I know now I was wrong, but I believed in it then." And I take that as being very credible.
After George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police, we saw millions of people protesting for civil rights across the nation. What do you think remains of Humphrey's civil rights platform?
It's an unfinished agenda. One of the things that Hubert Humphrey did as mayor and tragically never got to finish because he moved so quickly into the Senate was take on a bigoted, abusive, inbred police force in Minneapolis. And he had a great police chief named Ed Ryan who was helping him in it. In the 1940s, Hubert Humphrey saw the problem and was demoting racist officers. He saw the problem. He was sending the entire police force to get training at the University of Minnesota in what was called human relations. But that agenda ended when he went to the Senate. And even though there have been other reform-minded police chiefs and other very liberal mayors in Minneapolis, the power of the police union has only grown stronger over time.
Sam, and thank you so much for joining us. Sam Friedman, journalism professor at Columbia University, new book called Into the Bright Sunshine. We'll give a talk about the book November 13th in Madison, November 16th in Milwaukee. Find details at WPR.org/mornings. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel takes a comprehensive look at gun deaths in Wisconsin and analyzes detailed records county by county. We explore this new report based on statewide analysis and conversations with concerned gun owners, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John Dietrich is a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter, held an O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University that was integral to this project on gun deaths. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Your reporting reveals that homicides, police shootings, and accidents account for less than a third of all gunshot deaths in Wisconsin, the vast majority being suicides involving firearms. How does that discovery challenge our perceptions about guns?
Well, I appreciate those numbers just sort of settling. I've worked at the Journal Sentinel for almost 20 years now, and I've written a lot about those first three categories, and those are really important, and we're not really mindful of not setting aside or suppressing, if you will, those categories. But I think it's really important, and as I talk to public health officials, researchers and so forth, that the full picture of firearms deaths be understood. And I think what it really brought home for me as we looked at county by county data is that while the circumstances behind a suicide and homicide accident and so forth are naturally different, there is a commonality, if you will, of the means, and it is affecting everybody in our state, albeit in some different ways.
I just, when you map it out county by county and you look at the state as a whole, I was taken aback just by how pervasive it is, that it's, you know, the perception being that this is just confined to Milwaukee, perhaps. When you look at that map that you created, what do you see?
Well, it's really interesting. That was from the beginning, a thought about the map and how it changes when you include suicide and when you adjust for population. You know, what you see is a map that really changes from the focus being in southeastern Wisconsin. And again, not trying to diminish at all what is a really serious issue in Milwaukee and some other urban areas of the state with homicide, but the map changes pretty significantly, and the focus sort of visually goes to northern counties that are much smaller and are feeling a large burden, a heavy weight of these gun deaths. I went through the data, as I said, for these counties, and it is a lot of suicides in some of these counties. It's 100%, you know, that homicide is not a factor, say, in a county like, for instance, Iron County or Wood County. Some of these counties, it's 100% suicide. So you see the map change pretty significantly. And it, you know, it's a surprise. Milwaukee's not number one for gun deaths in the state. It's number seven when you adjust and include suicide. Let me just, before we go further too, let me just say that if somebody's hearing this and they're feeling suicidal, I just always want to make sure that people know that there's a resource, dialing 988. And I've just been trying to make sure to include that in our messaging in this project.
Yes, and it is through all of your reporting as well. Gun-involved suicides in Wisconsin exceed 500, according to your analysis of the state health data. And you found gun suicides are primarily taking the lives of rural and suburban residents. What might be causing that pattern?
Well, it's complex, you know, and I think one of the things that was really reinforced for me speaking with experts like Sarah Kolbeck and Jean Papalia, people who worked in this area, Debbie Trader, I think their caution is against finding a simple solution or a simple cause, if you will, and then solutions are not as simple either. But, you know, we're looking at a combination of financial stress, people being isolated, some pandemic, you know, results. Alcohol is a factor for sure in our state. Availability of firearms are a factor. And I think what's important and what was interesting to me and was reinforced a number of times is that gun owners themselves are not more prone to things like mental health challenges or even crises. But the point that was made is because of the means and the lethality of the means, it is by far the most lethal means of suicide, that when those things come up, it's really important to understand that there needs to be separation from those means in the times of crisis, that, you know, through maybe a death of a child or a divorce, something sudden like that, when the means are there and they're available, that's when the situation happens. And what's interesting too is that the research shows if even some minutes can be put between those means and the crisis, that can make the difference.
Wow.
In cases such as that.
We're talking about this new report on gun deaths in Wisconsin. John Dietrich, investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And you can join in at any point, call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John, as you talk there and talk about the diversity of people in Wisconsin, rural, urban, our state having a rich hunting tradition, I wonder, does that complicate the firearm deaths in Wisconsin?
Well, it's part of the factor to consider that is one of the reasons that somebody would own firearms would be hunting. And it's a great love, as you said, for a lot of people. There are people who have the gun that they've used and adored for many years for hunting has ended their lives in cases. We saw cases like that. I think it's what's really important to understand is how people view the firearms and how they think about it proactively around things like this is something that is a love for me. But maybe at this time, because of I tell a story in the project about somebody, Debbie Trader, and her husband held guns for a friend who loves hunting. And but they were in a period of time that was very difficult. And so what she and her husband did is they went and sat with the person. They had just gone through a very difficult situation, and they held on to those guns. For a while, everybody agreed that was, for the best. And they, Debbie and her husband took them to their house. This happens actually a lot. Research is showing about 30% of gun owners report holding guns for other people, other fellow gun owners in times of distress. And then the guns came back to the person for hunting, but they're kept in a different way right now. And so I think there's like a thought of it doesn't necessarily mean in some of these cases that the guns are gone forever, but that there is a thoughtful process and that others are involved in this and that person can hunt today and that there's some precautions put in place.
John Dietrich, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, sharing this new analysis on gun deaths in Wisconsin, a comprehensive look. Be part of the conversation. Call in with the question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter John Dietrich, whose project on gun deaths in Wisconsin provides a really nuanced look with statewide figures and these in-depth interviews with gun owners. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John, you interviewed dozens of gun owners for this series of reports. What surprised you? What came out from their perspectives?
Well, I think one of the things that I write in the project, an essay, reporter essay, which is sort of different for me. I've not done a lot of those in my career, and but I felt like it was appropriate because there was sort of a personal journey that went on here. Some of the stuff that was really surprising to me was things like, it's sort of obvious now, but I didn't really think about it before, but there really isn't a gun community. You know, that phrase, among others, gets used. And what I found with that, there's a lot of people who own this item, and they have different views and different life experiences. And so rather than try to take these interviews that I talk to people and sort of flatten them and say, well, like everybody kind of thinks this way, or this is a surprising thing, I wanted people's stories to sort of be able to breathe and be a little bit more expansive. And so that's what we did in this case, is tell people's, experiences of how they have engaged with the issue of mental health, firearms, what their relationship is with guns, how it was that they began to, you know, when they first owned a gun, what the experience was. And so I think what I think the word nuance is a good way to put it, because I found that it's more complicated than sometimes, you know, what we see on social media, which I think is more maybe indicative of the edges of some of these conversations. And I think there's a lot more nuance in the middle when you talk to gun owners. I just would also say too that there are different definitions that people have, and so we went to some efforts to not use some of the catchphrases that get used. And again, I'm not sort of casting aspersions on colleagues. I've used these phrases for years, so I see because of the fellowship some time in this. But terms like gun violence, responsible gun owners, things like that are interpreted and defined differently. So when I would talk to gun owners, I realized that there was not a shared understanding of some of those phrases. So rather than use those phrases, we got a little bit more descriptive, and that was an eye-opening thing for me.
How did you convince gun owners to talk with you for this project?
This is a really good question. So at the beginning, I thought this is going to be very difficult. And, you know, and there were some challenges with people being skeptical. You know, again, the media in general, we don't have, you know, we don't score super high right around Congress, I guess, sometimes in trust. I don't know. You know, it's part of the job, right? So I get that, you know, we're balkanizing to a lot of people. And sometimes we bring news, people just, you know, they don't want to hear, and it's part of what we do. But I did wonder about that. I mean, I think part of my background was helpful in that I covered the military at one time when I was in Colorado Springs, and I traveled embedded a few times, including to Iraq in 2003. So I had familiarity with guns. I'm not a gun owner. That's something that came up quite a bit from people would ask. But I've shot a lot because I've been out with the military. I used to cover the police department in Milwaukee and so forth. And I have a number of friends. Certainly. And so I guess that was helpful to some degree. But I think also it was my friend Jim Stingle, who retired from the paper, he and I had lunch. And, you know, he said it's almost like this was a story in plain view that we couldn't see, or I couldn't see, until I started calling people. Our former editor, George Stanley, who's a gun owner, he's the one who put me on this idea to begin with. He said, I think you'd be really surprised when you talk to gun owners. And I was really, you know, just honored by the willingness that people had to talk to me. And like I said, it started off with like one or two or three, and then it just became, you know, dozens of people, gun owners across the state, who talked to me, who, again, brought a variety of different life experiences, backgrounds, opinions, and just were super gracious in trusting and sharing their stories with me.
Giving their time, giving their honesty and transparency. So important to this. John Dietrich with us as we talk about gun deaths in Wisconsin. John is a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter and headed up this project. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Steve is here in Stoughton. Steve, hi. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for what I think is a really important conversation. I wanted to share a story, ask a question. I went to a session for caregivers of patients with people with dementia, and the session was about behaviors and how to respond to your family member with dementia. And what was interesting was that about 50% of the people there talked about their family member who had dementia, who owned guns, would bring the guns out, would handle them, and, you know, how do we respond to that when they want to keep their guns and all this stuff. So it was very, very interesting, and I was honestly shocked that there were that many people saying this was an issue for them. But I wonder in the research if dementia comes up and how that, like, it seems like a simple thing that we could just deal with. If you have dementia, we take away your gun, kind of thing. But anyway, I'm curious to know.
Steve, thank you so much for sharing your story with that and that education session. John, go ahead.
Yeah, that is a really good point. That's an area of research. There's a researcher out of Denver that I've spoken to quite a bit, Dr. Emmy Betts, who's worked in this area. This is a real issue, especially as we have aging population, individuals who have firearms, you know, and are approaching the sort of autumn of their life and so forth. And this hits home for people as to like what to do in this case. And I know a lot of families are entering in to this conversation. One of the things that Emmy Betts talks about is the volunteer nature of. That's always where these conversations start. Whether somebody is distressed in an organic, you know, sort of mental illness way, and dementia would be sort of an offshoot of that. Entering into these conversations and talking as a family, there are other measures. We don't have red flag law in Wisconsin, though there are measures where, you know, somebody, there is temporary detention of individuals. But those are extreme situations. And what Dr. Betts advised, and this is exactly what's being talked about now, is entering into this as a family and saying, you know, what sorts of things can we do at this point? Sometimes the individual who might not be aware and their wherewithal, they might not understand where they're at. And in those situations, perhaps more significant steps should be taken in that. And I think we're going to see more of that as the population ages. And it's just a really real question, too, when people are approaching the end of their life, kind of what happens to the firearms? And I know of situations where people will have essentially done this without the person's knowledge. That can be fraught, you know, to like remove the firearms without telling the person. And then, you know, if they have the wherewithal to remember that they at one time did have a firearm, you could create a situation. But it is an emerging area that there isn't a simple solution for. But I know, and I really appreciate, Steve, you bringing this forward, because this is a really important issue and one that I think a lot of families are grappling with.
You met gun owners and sellers trying to connect others with mental health services. Can you describe their efforts?
Well, this is a big category. So we had a piece. I met a gentleman named Mike Sedini. Mike's not from Wisconsin, but he's been to Wisconsin a lot for different gun events. He used to be a gun dealer, like he was in a gun importer. And he was really struck by the reluctance among gun owners to talk about mental health and mental wellness, that there was a gap between that world and the gun world. And he also would describe how he would come to gun shows and some people he knew, friends, were just not there anymore. And nobody was really talking about it. And it was because they had died by suicide. So he launched this group called Walk the Talk America. And what was so interesting is that through that group, and then also this effort, we can talk a little bit about gun shops stepping into this as being a storage location for people. There is an emerging conversation around mental health among firearms owners to say, hey, this is something to be more open to, and that some gun owners, for various reasons, are very reluctant to go and talk to therapists. Not all, don't want to paint a broad brush, you know, be careful in that area. But what Mike Sedini and some others are saying is, hey, let's be honest and let's say, hey, when we need help in the veteran community, that's emerging as a conversation, and in other places, let's also just be honest that there are some really bad outcomes that have happened and are happening with firearms.
John Dietrich, investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, describing his work to report out gun deaths in Wisconsin. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel publishes a first-of-its-kind analysis on gun deaths in Wisconsin, the series called Behind the Gun, sheds light on deaths that are difficult to track and shares these wide-ranging perspectives of gun owners. Call in with a question, add your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. And if you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, call or text the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 988, three digits, 988. John Dietrich is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, worked on this project. John, we heard from Suzanne in Manitowoc County, called in, and Suzanne is wondering if there's data detailing how many people in Wisconsin die by suicide using a gun under the age of 18. And then Suzanne has a follow-up question, wants to know how many people use a gun to take their own life due to age or terminal illness. Did your data from the counties go into that?
The age categories are available, not for every county. This effort, Wisconsin has a decentralized death investigation system, so we went out to every county and pulled that data, and so we got various kinds of data. So sometimes we got age data. And I can tell you just from broadly from the State Department of Health, which has these numbers, you know, sort of across the state, that there is a category, you know, under 18, and that is a growing category. In terms of the overall numbers, the largest category of gun suicides are white males over the age of 50 in rural counties, though there's some important categories that are growing. Among African American, for instance, in Milwaukee County, we've seen some uptick. African American and Latino girls in Milwaukee County, we've seen some of those increase. And again, the CDC numbers that firearms are the number one cause of death for children right now. Suicide is part of that. And it's really important in that case to talk about access to firearms, that in this case, that somebody who owns a firearm, they themselves might be, you know, in a good spot with mental illness or mental health or mental wellness, if you will, but somebody in their house may not be. And a number of gun owners that I talked to were very mindful, not just of their own situation, but who is with them in the house. Do they have small children? Do they have teenagers who could be going through some, you know, some difficult times? And it's really important in that category to secure the firearms, that they're not accessible to people who do not have access or should not have access to them. And that certainly would be a teenager who's going through a difficult time. But yes, that is a category that has been growing. And as for the first time last year, as you mentioned, we crossed over 500 gun deaths by firearm in Wisconsin. And the number or the percentage of firearm deaths, it's gone up 100% since 2004. And in that time, suicide is a big category. And to your second point about the end of life, that is a category that I've heard from other other individuals. And that's clearly, it doesn't come out in the data because you know, some of the circumstances around it are not marked. So you have to go into the detail of the reports to see what was going on. But we have a very powerful story from Kurt Green, who is from Manitowoc County. And he tells that he's the coroner of Manitowoc County. And he's really interesting in that he is a strong Second Amendment supporter and a strong Democrat. And he's had a lot of this sort of tragedy in his life. And his grandfather took his life. He had cancer. And you know, it's a very difficult situation for families. And it's come up quite a bit in the numbers that's what's happening in a number of these cases.
You bring up Manitowoc County Coroner Kirk Green, who was particularly cooperative with this project. What do you think motivated him to help you with this project?
Well, it's interesting. He did jump off, if you will, of the data. So we went out to all 72 counties, and Kurt came back with data that was way more detailed even than, say, Milwaukee County or Waukesha or Dane. And because what he's doing is he's creating categories that are not required by the state. He is interested truly, as he's an elected coroner, to communicate with the people of Manitowoc County about what's going on, not only in this category, but things like overdoses and so forth. He's a former paramedic. Mm-hmm. One of his deputies is an ER doctor. So they have a level of professionalism that, you know, not every coroner has in the state, certainly. And, you know, his personal story, I mentioned his grandfather dying by suicide when Kurt was young, when he was 6 years old. But then he had other cases that had come up. His sister and his nephew were murdered by his brother-in-law, who then took his life. And he himself has a situation with his father, who was approaching the end of his life, and dementia was a factor there. And he was asking for his guns back, and Kurt and the family were like, no, we're not going to do that. You know, and then his day job, so to speak, is coroner. He sees a lot of this. So Kurt was really motivated to share this data. There's going to be an event that they're actually planning in Manitowoc, where he's going to talk about Manitowoc's data, Manitowoc County, for the residents there. And I'm going to come and attend that and talk a little bit about the plan is for me to talk a little bit about what we found statewide as well, to help inform the public as to what's going on.
Meanwhile, digging just a bit into your reporter's notebook here, the State Health Department collects comprehensive detailed data about violent deaths, but the department wouldn't provide you with that information. Why was that?
Well, there are what's happening here is there are two laws that are colliding, as they explained it from the state. This data has been collected for 20 years. The CDC directed the states, and Wisconsin was one of the first ones to do this. And so this is collecting data not around just gun deaths, but any violent deaths, so car crashes and things of that nature, for public health researchers and officials to act upon it. So the state collects this data. It's closely guarded because there is a state law that protects the privacy of individuals after death, and protecting their families' privacy. There is a way. So under the open records law, which is the law that we typically use as media, that's how we get records. There is a way to get the data. Researchers routinely get it. And because I was at Marquette, we sought the data that way. And the state said, you know, we just can't sort of see past the fact that you are a reporter, so to speak. So we know you're going to write stories and you're not a researcher in the sort of traditional sense. So we're not going to give you the data. It was frustrating because the state collects this data. Mm-hmm. They've been behind, but they collect this data and they put it together, but they wouldn't give it to us. So then my students and I ended up sort of embarking on this large effort to go to every county in the state. And the coroners and medical examiners, 71 of 72 counties gave us the data. It was, like I said, a varying quality, but you can see online, there's a lookup tool that my colleague Andrew Hahn created that will allow people in every county in the state to basically get a snapshot of not only what's happening statewide, but what's happening in their county.
John Dietrich is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with a new report on gun deaths, comprehensive statewide look. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Marcus in Milwaukee is here. Marcus, hi. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Kate. So I went to Tulsa West in the 90s. My friend's father, who was the associate principal, was gunned down in the hallway. This is constantly a topic that we keep addressing, but we're not addressing in terms of trying to come to some sort of resolution on how to lower gun deaths. In terms of the dementia thing, would it be possible to take and create some sort of technological solution where people who have guns and are getting up there in age are required to get a safe that has a two-person system to access the safe? That way the owner could still maintain their dignity and could still go hunt with family members, but there would have to be somebody else there who is then able to open the safe with them. to make sure that they're cognizant and that they're at their functioning level, and then make sure that the guns are stowed safely.
Marcus, thank you. What about tech interventions and innovations, John? What did you find out?
Well, this is really interesting. First of all, my condolences for your loss. I grew up in Wauwatosa, so I remember this case quite well. And you're right. This is a conversation that's gone on for a long time. What struck me a little bit that at least I wasn't aware of is these conversations among gun owners, and particularly among conversations in that group around technology. There's new technology that I was not aware of to exactly what you're talking about, which is two-party access to safes. There are multiple reasons why that might be the case. There is technology now that allows that could, have cell phones so that a loved one or trusted person could be, accessed. They would be notified if the gun owner wanted to get access to their firearm. This is coming up right now with people who need a break, and they maybe do not want to remove firearms from the home entirely. So they might two-factor that with a spouse or a family member, or they could lock themselves away from them for 30 days. The technology allows that. And it's advanced to the point where I think there was some years ago skepticism about the accessibility, but the technology has come, has been explained to me, a long way. And so you're seeing discussions among gun owners, including at gun shows, say this is a really smart thing. For years and years, I didn't know this, but for years and years, gun owners have been, as a precaution with their own mental health, have put pictures of their loved ones on their safe. So when they go to remove their gun, they're thinking about the person that is closest to them, their children, spouse, and so forth. That was sort of an old school way, and it's still done. Mm-hmm. But technology provides some new opportunities. And I think that that's a really interesting observation in the area of dementia, that here would be a possibility to keep the dignity, but also provide separation. So it's not immediately accessible.
John Dietrich, investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, providing insights on his new series called Behind the Gun, detailing gun deaths across the state and interviews with gun owners. Be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
The people of Wisconsin are at the heart of everything we do here at WPR. Hi, I'm WPR Director Sarah Ashworth. Beginning May 20th, we're reorganizing our networks to make it easier to find the news and music programs you love. All your favorite hosts will be on WPR News and WPR Music, ensuring a bright future from our service to you. Find everything you need to know about these exciting changes at WPR.org/new.
Today at 11 on The Larry Miller Show, our physical therapist will talk about neck pain and take your other PT questions as well. Join with those questions at 11 on The Larry Miller Show.
All of us want to know what's going on, but only some of us want to know the why. That's where we come in. 1A is a place for the curious. Daily conversations for those looking to make sense of our world. I'm Jen White. I hope you'll join me next time for 1A.
This morning at 9 on the Ideas Network.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how Wisconsinites view guns in a new special report from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that provides statewide analysis on gun deaths and in-depth interviews with gun owners. The series is called Behind the Gun. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Dietrich is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, on the Sentinel's website, you can see these really detailed statistics, county by county, and a breakdown there. I mean, why explore this data snapshot in your own county, your own community? Why is that valuable?
Our initial proposal or statement was that how do gun deaths affect you where you are, wherever you might be reading this? And I think the thought, and it's understandable why this is, that I think that the focus goes to certain kinds of deaths. I have a friend of mine, and I quote him in the story, the essay. He's a former Army intelligence officer, and he said, John, you know, part of the problem in the media is that you guys focus on the unusual and you suppress the usual. And I was sort of defensive about that at first. And I said, well, in this category, I think, it, you know, and others, but in this category, I think it's definitely true. So there is this large category of deaths that people in parts of the state might not know about at all. Even people who maybe have some inkling of this, because especially around the issue of suicide, there's a lot of shame, there's a lot of secrecy, there's not a lot of public reporting. So people have been very surprised. And I think what we wanted to bring home to people is that here's a little bit of information where I should say where people's privacy is protected. We're very mindful of the concerns that the state has and that others have. And Andrew Hahn, our developer who created this, was careful and respectful in how we created this. But we wanted to give people a sense that this is affecting you in ways, because it's not homicide. Maybe some of the steps would be different. They would be, certainly, whether those countermeasures be voluntary, government-involved, a combination thereof, but that it is affecting every county in the state, albeit in different ways.
One county, Trempealeau, didn't provide you with gun death data. Why might that be?
Well, yeah, so that was an interesting case. The coroner, Bonnie Kinsey, is the she's an elected official. So the way it works in Wisconsin is that there are counties that have elected coroners, and then there's appointed medical examiners. So that coroner is like the county clerk or so forth. They run for office, their constitutional office. And so when because they're a constitutional officer, they're, you know, in control of the records that they keep. And our reporting indicated, you know, as we were going through all the counties, this was one county where we were not getting any cooperation at all. And we did involve lawyers, first for from Gannett Corporation, Tom Curley, and then Tom Kamenik, who runs a firm here in Wisconsin. And through those efforts, we were able to get data from 71 of the 72 counties. Bonnie Kinsey was very clear that she was not going to give me the records or give us the records. And again, we worked all different ways. I actually went to Whitehall, which is the county seat. It's south of Eau Claire County. And she just was, as we say, not feeling it. It was not happening. And so that was the one county where we didn't have you know, any data. And, you know, Bill, leaders from the FOIA Council in Madison commented clearly that, he felt like this was a violation of the open records law, that at least Bonnie should have shown us or allowed us to inspect the records. But she would not do that. I do have to highlight that I was really encouraged by all the other counties that came forth. And there's a lot of people out there who are really doing their best, underpaid, under-resourced, working with their own computers. Sometimes people who are doing this work out in counties who were super helpful and cooperative with us. And I was really, really encouraged by that. And I have to say, disappointed and discouraged what happened in Trempealeau.
I notice as we talk here, you use a lot of people's names as we go along this conversation. Sources' names, the people who worked on this effort. It almost feels as if it takes a village, so to speak, that line to really capture a bigger sense of what is happening, a comprehensive look at gun deaths.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It really was when, and that's where what the reporter's essay was able to really do is allow me to really help recognize how this effort started. And again, this, like I say, the story wasn't my idea. George Stanley, it was his idea, our former editor, and Greg Borowski, who's now our editor in chief, has very kindly and amazingly stayed as the word editor on this. And Daphne Chen, who's our investigations editor, she shepherded it through. But I mean, this started, you know, sort of in an office at Marquette, last summer. And it just became clear to me that this work was really important, that we were telling stories and we had an opportunity to tell stories in a different way. And it was going to require a lot of people to sort of bring this to light. And, you know, my Alex Rivera Grant and Ben Schultz were my students at Marquette, and they just did amazing work. They just were unflappable through the process. And I really feel blessed by all the support that came at Marquette. Dave Umhafer, who some of you will know from his work at the Journal Sentinel, is the director over at the O'Brien Fellowship. I just remember late night conversations with the people trying to get our heads around what is the framing of this? What are we trying to see? And I think that, you know, it ended up being encapsulated in the project name, which is, you know, as you've mentioned, Behind the Gun. What we're trying to do is not only get that data, but most importantly, to get the human stories, the humanity, and really lead with that. And that was, you know, that was our goal. And bringing in all these other folks who helped us, I couldn't have done it without them.
We only have about 20 or so seconds left. You want to continue reporting and covering this issue. Where does it go next?
Yes. So our next piece, we're looking at attitudes among gun owners, opinions, practices. That's an area that we're working on now. We're also very interested in some of the cases that have been raised by your listeners that are intervenable, particularly accidental shootings. And that's a category, while a small percentage, there is some places for public health officials and actions to really have an effect there.
John, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
John Dietrich, investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, worked on Behind the Gun as part of an O'Brien Fellow in Public Service Journalism at Marquette. If you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, call or text the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 988 or text HOME to the National Crisis Text Line at 741-741. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.